soon to this theater, a ghastly, ghoulish, and totally incredible motion picture. The Werewolf versus the Vampire Woman. This is Wandesa, Queen of the Vampires and Satan's favorite mistress. Werewolves and vampires will reign supreme, and things will happen that have never been seen by human beings. Your blood will boil and your flesh will crawl. No one can escape the vampires, and no one can run from the werewolves. If you can take it, see the most sensational fight to the finish ever filmed. See the Werewolf versus the Vampire Woman.
Coming to you from the most horrible, most miserable place on earth.
Cocktail.
This is the Out of the Coffin Podcast. This is your host, Dan Charette, writer, geek, vampire aficionado. This is the podcast by vampire fans for vampire fans. On this podcast, we discuss topics that you may decide are not kid-friendly, so listener discretion is advised. Also, as we discuss TV shows and movies, we will probably have spoilers along the way. Before we get started, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to drop us a line, you can do that at outofthecoffin.com/contact, or you can leave us voicemail at 206-350-7638. All right, welcome to episode number 56 of the Out of the Coffin podcast. My name is Dan Charette, and I am here all alone tonight. Michelle's at work. She's had a pretty interesting schedule. She's feeling better. She's been, you know, I think everyone's had kind of a bit of a flu or sniffles or just general weather-changing blahs for a while, and it's been going around, but everyone's getting to feel a little better now. Anyway, she's off at work, so I'm here all alone. But I wanted to make sure I got an episode out in February for everyone. My apologies for the delay in episodes here. If you've been following Lilith's Love, you know that it's been technical difficulties, a lot of technical difficulties with recording, including Audacity, which I used to record this podcast, and Lilith's Love, and my computer just generally being non-user friendly, let's put it that way. So with focusing on Lilith's Love and getting episode 6 done, that has meant that unfortunately Out of the Coffin has sort of taken a back seat, and I apologize. I certainly did not expect it to take almost a month and a half between episodes. My goal was to at least have an episode a month. Technically I did that, but it's been more than 30 days, so that's, you know, not a good thing. I'm rambling, and I need to stop doing that, because for this episode, I have for you all the incredibly awesome interview that I had with the lovely and talented Gail Carriger, author of Solace, which I have mentioned before on the podcast. I'm not going to chat here for too much longer, but it is definitely worth the listen. I hope you enjoy it. I had a lot of fun chatting with her, and I hope you guys enjoy the interview. But before I get to that, I did want to mention that I have confirmed that I am going to be one of the guest authors at the Storycasting Meetup on March 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. in Tempe, Arizona. So if you happen to be in the Tempe, Phoenix area of Arizona, and you can get to Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe on the 13th of March, I would love to see you there. I will have copies of Lilith's Love to do signings with, and I'll also have book plates if we do run out of books. You know, here's hoping, right? So I've got a link to the website where you can RSVP in the show notes, and like I said, I hope to see you all there. Now, because this is going to be mostly an interview episode, I'm going to play that interview after a promo, and I won't be playing any music afterwards, and I won't be coming back after the interview. So enjoy this interview with Gail Carriger, and I hope to see you all real soon.
So, have you heard from T?
He's taking it day by day, focusing on what's important right now.
Gotta be tough. Raising a kid on your own and all? I mean, I got two. It's not cheap raising them.
Yeah, but T's employed now. I'm sure he's gonna be fine.
That's it. He's a social media professional now.
Oh, frack. We gotta do something to help that kid.
On the 27th of February 2010 at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, members of the social media community are holding an auction to benefit T's 5-year-old daughter, known in our circles as Sonic Boom.
We want to show a little girl that while her life has changed, that her opportunities are limitless.
Please join us in celebrating the future of Sonic Boom. We want to make sure she's supported through social media before the teat that her daddy's sucking at runs dry. Please visit www.theboomeffect.org for more information.
Thank you for coming back and joining us on the Out of the Coffin podcast. I am joined on the phone with the lovely and talented Gail Carriger, who is the author of Soulless, which is my current favorite novel right now. Its sequel, Changeless, hits shelves March 30th, if I'm correct. And I've already pre-ordered it. I am very excited. And the third book, Blameless, comes out in September, last I heard. So thank you for joining me tonight, Gail.
Oh, it is absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
So am I correct on those dates? Are they that soon?
Yes, they really are that soon.
Yay.
So, yeah, and probably the second book, Changeless, will be around in brick and mortars at least a little before the 30th. They seem, there's no gag on the book, so it kind of hits shelves whenever the stores get a hold of it. So
right. When the ink dries and the boxes arrive.
Exactly. And yeah, and they're releasing the third one this year as well in September. So I don't have an actual date for that one, but I'm working on the copy edits as we speak. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, then definitely thank you for saving some time for this chat.
Oh, it's anything to procrastinate.
Oh, yes, I know how that goes. Although I have to ask, see, I am a fan of podcasts, as I know you are as well, and I heard your chat with Mer Lafferty, and did I hear you right that it took you 3 months, at least initially, to write Soulless?
Yeah, it takes me 3 months to write a rough draft. That's kind of my sort of standard. But it also takes me 3 months to edit. I'm a heavy editor, and I actually really enjoy the editing process. So I whip out a rough draft pretty fast, but nobody else gets to see it, and then I take a while to edit it back. So really it takes me 6 months to write something.
So I was going to say, I don't know where you could fit in procrastination if you're able to get a book through that fast.
Well, it's also a strange coincidence that whenever I'm really, really busy, I seem to write more. So when I was first writing that book, I was doing about three other things, a couple of jobs, and so, of course, I managed to write. Now, I have all this time on my hands, and I can't write anything.
Ain't that the way?
Yes.
So the first thing I want to ask you, because this is the thing I keep finding most fascinating as I encounter you online, is either you're past or currently an archaeologist.
That's absolutely true.
Tell me about
secret
this.
Identities.
I want, you don't have to reveal your secret identity, but I want to know where you have been, what kind of digs you've been to, or all that good stuff. I want to know about the archaeology before we get to the writing.
Sure, absolutely. Let me see. I've always wanted to be an archaeologist. So one of my earliest childhood memories is running up the garden path when I was about six with this bone I dug out of the compost pile that I was convinced was a dinosaur bone.
Excellent.
Which I know is paleontology, but anyway, that started the madness. And so pretty much I was one of those really driven kids and just in hot pursuit of archaeology my entire life. I ended up, I have dual citizenship with England, and so I actually ended up doing my master's degree in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So the first excavation I was on was way back in 1996, 97. I was on an Etruscan excavation in northern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was pretty good. It was lots of fun. And I actually discovered pretty quickly, that was where I did my field school, that I actually don't enjoy actual physical archaeology all that much after all that.
It's the research.
It's terribly boring. It's so boring. Sitting there digging in the dirt and then sifting things.
Mm-hmm.
But I was fortunate, or not so fortunate, to chop my hand open.
Oh, no.
Slicing bread for lunch. I know it's very inglorious injury. But effectively, I couldn't actually physically do any excavation anymore, and so they stuck me, respectively, doing field survey with a laser survey machine, which I thought was fantastic because you get to go dashing through the Italian forests with a machete and finding ruins. And so that was pretty fun. And then I also ended up in the lab. We had a field lab off-site near the excavation, but in a little kind of museum in the basement of this little an attic of this museum. And I'm a potter as well, by a sort of artistic preference.
Sure.
And so I was really good at identifying pottery, and I could just tell whether something had been handmade and how it was fired. They didn't have to train me. And so they kind of adopted me, and I got invited back the next year to the same excavation as a supervisor to help with the field school in the pottery sorting shed. So, and that really spearheaded my career. I actually went into the scientific side of archaeology after that. So my training is as a materials scientist, which is to look at inorganic excavated artifacts.
Cool.
So I've done some work with museums, and after Italy, I switched gears and I did some work on a bunch of artifacts out of a site in Syria, a 12th century Islamic site, which was really interesting.
Wow.
And I got my master's of science doing that, and now I'm associated with a fantastic site in the highlands of Peru near Cusco.
Ooh.
So, yeah, I get to travel down to Peru every year. It's pretty fun.
That sounds awesome.
It really is. It's a wonderful, like, the site itself is really exciting. It's a true kind of romantic archaeological site, massive ruins,
mm-hmm.
and a huge corpus of excavated material that really hasn't had a lot of processing done to it that can really reveal quite a bit about sort of Wari to Inca to colonial transition time periods in that area, which is a big span of time, which is not a lot is known about. So being able to study the pottery from this particular area is really exciting. So I'm having a wonderful time with that. And yeah, so that's the archaeology.
Wow.
I know it seems very glorious, but I do spend most of my time sort of nose down looking at small fragments of pottery.
Well, yeah, it's not all Indiana Jones, right? But hey, you get to go through jungles with a machete. That's pretty darn cool.
Yeah, that part was fun. And we still do, I mean, don't tell anybody, but we still do, you know, get it into trouble when we're climbing about the ruins and, you know, breaking into haciendas and that sort of thing and
gasp.
Finding. And, of course, the Inca stuff is pretty exciting for somebody who, my second stint in graduate school was in North America, where there isn't a whole lot of large civilizations and archaeology, but there are some very strange rules to somebody like me who's classically trained to do with human remains because of NAGPRA and sort of native people's restrictions on excavating human remains and
right.
repatriation and that sort of thing. And in Peru, those laws don't exist. In fact, they're very casual about bodies. And the Inca were really excited about burying bodies under walls and in the corners of rooms. And so when we're excavating down there, you know, there's another body coming out of the ground. Everybody come and see. There are bodies everywhere, which I've never encountered before. And actually, it's the pottery that's quite a bit more valuable. So human remains are quite common, and whole pot remains are very uncommon and very valuable. So it's an interesting thing for me to have switched kind of mental approaches to that as an archaeologist. So I still get excited to find, you know, skulls or something, but no one else is very thrilled down in the Peruvian areas. So, but it really is a lot of fun.
Very cool. So this probably has led to your love of history and cultures and research.
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely. Let's step back then and talk about Solis, because I kind of glossed over it, but although I've mentioned it on the podcast many times, like the fanboy that I am, it's going to be very difficult for me to pinpoint a genre, and I don't think you could, except for maybe, I think I saw, who was it, maybe it was even J. Daniel Sawyer who'd called it urbane fantasy, or is it somebody else who used that term?
It was Carrie Vaughn conned the term.
Okay.
But I sort of misappropriated it, and Dan and a couple of the other podcasters and friends of mine have kind of gone around applying that to Solis, because it does sort of seems to suit it. But you know, credit where it's due. It was Carrie Vaughn who came up with it. But yeah, urbane fantasy, that's what I like to call it.
So it has vampires, it has werewolves, a couple of my favorite things. It has Victorian England, it has steampunk goodness. It has humor. It has Nookie in it.
It has a little Nookie, yes.
A little Nookie in it. And it's just a brilliant story. I enjoyed all of the characters. If I had to rank them in order, of course, I loved Alexia and Lord Macan, but my hands-down favorite is Lord Akeldama.
Yay! I loved him very much, too.
So
they're all my babies, so don't tell the others. But
okay, I promise.
I have a real affection for
I
them.
I did enjoy them all. Flute was also very awesome. But where did you come up with the story or the idea? What sparked the idea for Solis?
Originally, way back. Well, it's kind of because it's such a mashup. It's sort of everything but the kitchen sink, and it was all these things that I loved. You know, mm-hmm. I enjoy urban fantasy. I really like alternate history. And steampunk was just kind of coming onto the radar when I started to write this. And I just thought, I'm going to put them all in one book. But I had to come up with sort of a main character, and I really wanted a good twist on the vampire werewolf thing. And so what I actually ended up doing was researching the science of the time period. Mm-hmm. And it is the root of archaeology as a field of study. You know, mm-hmm. antiquities collecting started in this time period. So that's kind of what I'm familiar with, is the early science and the early social sciences that were beginning in this time. And I'm also familiar with Gothic literature as a genre, because I'm just sort of interested in Victorian literature. So mm-hmm. I had these two interests. And then I just started poking about, and I discovered that there was this American scientist who wanted to weigh the soul. The movie 21 Grams is based off of his research. And there was this whole idea that the soul was a physical thing that you could comprehend and understand. And I was like, well, there's all these other theories going on about counterbalance theorems where everything in nature has a balance in nature as well. Kind of like the idea that growing next to a poisonous plant is going to be the antidote. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to hypothesize that vampires and werewolves and ghosts are running around Victorian London getting involved in things, then there's got to be something that is their opposite. Mm-hmm. It's not their prey, but that is something that could kind of cancel them out. If I'm sticking with the whole scientific thing, and that's kind of one of the conceits of my universe, is that theoretically and within the confines of Victorian science, so it wouldn't necessarily make sense to modern scientists, but within Victorian science, everything can be explained.
Mm-hmm.
So vampires and werewolves can be explained by Victorian scientists, and they're struggling to do so because they are Victorian scientists and they want to explain everything, including the soul and the presence of the supernatural in their midst. And so I came up with the idea that there would have to be this kind of probably quite rare neutralizer or electrical ground for the abilities that vampires and werewolves have. And that's where my character came from. So I was like, oh, I'm going to make her female. I'm going to make female really unusual. And it'll give her this kind of prosaic personality, because the idea then was that vampires and werewolves can become immortals from being human because they have excess soul. They have extra. And that's what survives the bite. And what Alexia has is no soul whatsoever, and that's how she cancels them out. Right. And then so it has sort of some personality traits which make her into this kind of spinstery, brash, blue stocking type of female, which is slightly more common in the Victorian era than we give it credit for. But so that's where she came from. That was the root of it all.
Very cool. I thought the soulless idea was very interesting, and it took me a minute to wrap my brain around it, because I always assume or believe that there's a soul, and what it is or who it is or where it is not really relevant, but that people have one. And the idea that someone could not have a soul and still be animate and running around and being very Alexia was hard at first to comprehend, and then it was like, just get over it. It's just awesome, and and it does fit, and it makes perfect sense. So I got to give you credit. I never would have thought of that idea before. So
thank
kudos.
You. Thank you very much. It was, I mean, like I said, it did spring from this idea of weighing the soul and thinking of the soul as kind of a physical organ that maybe some people don't have and some people do have. And it is part of the series of books that Alexia herself is trying to understand it, as well as all, you know, a number of different kinds of scientists in England and Europe are all trying to comprehend what this means to have a soul or to not have one, and how you can live without one. And of course, somebody like Alexia, the respective churches and religious bodies have all given up on, because all the scientists have claimed, you know, she has no soul, therefore there's no point in trying to save her, because she's just going to die anyway. So this is that quality as well. And I do begin to explore some more repercussions of the condition, shall we say, as we move on through the series.
Excellent. Okay, well, I had another question, and it's for my own curiosity. I know the novel is set in Victorian England, but was there a specific year in mind, or does it not really matter because it's alternate history anyways?
There is a specific year. I actually, it's alt history, but I try to sort of fit my conceits and differences around the actual historical events that are going on at the time period. So I will mention wars, or I will mention an act of parliament that's going through London, and those are actually things that are going on at the time. I just happen to have werewolves fighting in the front lines or something like that. So the year in mind for Solus is about 1873, kind of late 1873. So late Victorian. Mm-hmm. And it is this particular time period is in some ways quite a bit more progressive than we tend to think of the Victorian era. I mean, there's a lot of industry and scientific changes that have gone on between sort of the 1850s to the 1870s, which interests me, too, so I get to poke around and do research about this. they knew about germs, you know? they figured out cholera. They had syringes, you know, all these things. I'm like, they're pretty advanced, actually.
Right.
But, yeah, I will chuck in my own inventions and my own creatures, of course, into the time period. But I do try to stick as closely as possible to that year. And then the next couple of books are 1874, 1875.
Okay. Werewolves, of course, play a large part in Solus.
And they do. I like the fuzzy.
Yes. And no offense to Lord Macan, but I am a vampire freak, and I really enjoyed Lord Akeldama. So one of my questions is, will we see more of the hives and the drones in the next two books?
You're going to, let me think. This is the sort of the issue with being a writer, is that I'm actually working on the third book right now, and it's the second book that's coming out. So I have to kind of remind myself what's going on in the second book. The second book you get a little bit more werewolves, actually, in the second book. There's some vampires. But the second book, I wanted to kind of explore a little bit more about Lord Macan and how he ended up a Scot in London, and why he abandoned his old pack and stuff like that. But there are definitely vampires mucking about. The second book is two POVs, so you get Lyle's perspective in London, and you get Alexia's in Scotland. And Lyle does get a little embroiled with the hives, we'll say.
Okay.
And then the third book, which I'm working on right now, has quite a bit of vampire in them. So you get your fill of vampire in the third book. And actually thinking if there are future books that we're going to see even more of vampires. So don't worry.
Future books. Ooh,
cool.
Excellent. All right. Okay, so another question I had about the vampires was, I found it interesting that not all of them, but for the most part, at least the vampires that we see in Solas are effeminate dandies, and I would say they're homosexual. They are gay vampires.
Well, you get the hive. You do get the hive, which
yes.
has some pretty heterosexual straight
yes.
men. But Lord Akeldama, who is the main sympathetic vampire,
yes.
I would say, is mm-hmm. definitely gay. I've got no shame there. He's gay. He's a gay character.
And not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just
not
saying.
No,
it's
not.
Very obvious. And
yes.
And the werewolves are also very clearly alpha male. Even Lyle as a beta is very clear. He knows his place, but he's definitely masculine.
You'll get there's a new, slightly more effeminate werewolf character who comes in the second book. So I do, one of the things I love to do as a writer is set up a lot of stereotypes and tropes. So I set up Alexia as kind of the battle axe, tough female, and I set up Lord Macan as your sort of standard, gruff, slightly scruffy alpha male,
mm-hmm.
and I'm setting up Lord Akeldama as this rather effete, quintessentially homosexual kind of Oscar Wilde character.
Mm-hmm.
And I you know, don't get too comfortable because I love upsetting tropes. So I love to sort of set up all of my characters. Even Ivy, the frivolous best friend with the obsession with really silly hats.
Yes.
There will be dazzling, so be wary. But I've always, part of that is my own perspective on vampires. I have always kind of perceived them as a little effeminate.
See, that's where I'm going with this. What was it that made you go that way? Because, I mean, certainly I could point to Interview with the Vampire and Anne Rice's series.
Mm.
But was there a conscious decision for you to say, okay, my vampires are going to be different than your usual, and was there a specific reason why, or was it just it fit the story and again, not that there's anything wrong with it. And with Akeldama, it's just you can't help but love him. He's just so awesome. And he's right out there, and his outfits are great, and it's like,
yes,
wow.
Colorful. Yes.
Colorful is the right word.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things in play here. The first of one is if you're going to be dealing with vampires, as an author, there are sort of standards in place. You know, I mean, there's the original gothic vampire of Dracula, or even earlier, you know, like from early not named vampires, like from The Monk or something like that, who are sinister, predatorial monsters,
right.
usually sexualized just to a certain, you know, fearsome anti-Victorian prudishness degree,
right.
Particularly preying on young women. So you have kind of that vampire that you can do the real, and then you have the sort of early 1950s vampire who is a caricature of a monster without much humanization at all. And then you have the sort of the new wave of vampires as this romantic, suave,
sparkly
hero, urbane hero that can come in. So and I was kind of like, well, what can I do with these different tropes in place? So that was one thing I was thinking about, and I wanted to do, what's the most opposite of a vampire, this dark, brooding, romantic, monstrous hero that we're used to thinking about?
Yay.
Or anti-hero,
right.
And that is an incredibly colorful, blonde, bright, peppy dandy who's immersed in the London actors and, you know, who's just full of life, really.
Right.
So that was part of it. I was kind of poking fun, in a way, with that approach. And the other thing I always think about is these creatures are immortal.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I imagine getting very bored with a lot of the standards of vampirism if you're an immortal. Like, who wants to go around dressed in a black cloak all the time saying, blah, right?
Exactly.
They're going to be, yeah, and I think Lord Akeldama's approach to that is to really kind of make fun of everything. He's such an old vampire that at this point, everything about life has kind of turned into a joke for him, and it's his way of keeping his own sanity. And I'd also, I mean, I was born and raised in San Francisco, so I had a lot of uncles, shall we say, and I wanted, I mean, again, if you're going around biting different types of people, then you get different types of people as vampires.
Absolutely.
And so that's another aspect of his character. So, yeah, those were all in play when I was thinking about him, which is part of the reason I think people find him so appealing as a character, is he's pretty well-rounded in my head. You know, I know exactly what he's like. But he's not the only one who's going to be representing for alternative sexuality,
okay.
Shall we say.
Excellent.
There will be more.
Excellent. It's good to see, too.
Yeah, it's fun to write. It's fun, and I'm subversive, I admit to it. I like to put in likable characters that, you know, just happen to be gay, or they happen to be really strong women, or they happen to be slightly chubby, or all of those things, because I think that the way to change the way people think and how accepting people are is by simply accepting it yourself as a writer when you're writing about it. So, anyway, I'm not going to preach or anything, but he is a favorite character of mine, so I'm glad that you like him.
Yes, and I was kind of shocked, I don't know, when you had mentioned in the email that we had previously that you were glad to hear from a male point of view an opinion of the novel. And I was kind of curious, I mean, have you not heard from a lot of male readers? I mean, certainly I know Chris and J. Daniel Sawyer love your book, and I mean...
Well, they kind of have to. They're my friends.
Right. And I don't know you, and I love it. So there you go.
I think when Orbit picked up the book, I mean, you can kind of tell from the cover, this great pink slashes across the cover, that the target market was clearly not the straight male, shall we say. And so I kind of assumed just from the packaging that, and because urban fantasies, by and large, do tend to sell to women, it's the largest sort of consumer bracket, that I wouldn't have many male fans. And so I'm always extremely delighted. I mean, I'm delighted when anybody sends me a mail. It's still a unique and exciting thing to me when I get an email that says someone liked my book. You know, it's a first-time author thing, I suspect. I hope I don't become jaded, but it still gives me a thrill whenever I get that. But I am always slightly surprised when it's a male, I will say.
Well,
so, I mean, it was quite thrilling to me. My first blog review online was from a male blogger, and he was very kind of complimentary and sweet. So I should be expecting it by now, but I am still surprised.
Because, I mean, I'll admit I'm not a typical male. I do like romances. I do like vampires. I do like werewolves. I like Victorian stories. I like historical stories. So you basically wrote a book for me. but it did still take me aback. It was like, whoa, I mean, what is the target audience for the novel? And I can understand that. Plus, it is a romance novel on top of everything else. But I got to say, thank you for the nookie in there, because that definitely cranks up a notch. And I enjoyed that as well, and it was quite nice. Have you found many young adult readers are picking up Soulless?
Well, thank you for asking. Actually, I just won the Alex Award, which was very exciting.
Excellent. Congratulations.
Thank you. Which is an American Library Association award that's given to an adult book that will appeal to young adult readers. So I already had, when I was first launching the book, Orbit actually flew me out to the BEA, which is the big book expo in New York. Mm-hmm. And I already had people asking me, it's one of the questions you just tend to get as an author, is this, what age group is your book appropriate for, especially from librarians? Because they're actually often searching for books that are kind of entree adult books. So most libraries, and I remember this from when I was working in libraries, there's always a couple of kids who are real voracious readers.
Yeah.
And, you know, they make their way quite happily through everything that's young adult, and they're ready to move on pretty quickly to adult stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're always searching for books for those kids that's something that they can read, but that's still kind of young adult appropriate. And I am fortunate in my cover in that the cover itself doesn't indicate any age. So it is. Right. I didn't sell to a romance house, so it doesn't have a bodice ripper cover. And I think, and this is a strange thing to say, but I think I actually have picked up male readers because you can be seen holding my book. And there are, you know, there are not significant, but there are a number of male readers who, like you, do enjoy romances and do enjoy, you know, alt history and that kind of thing, but are embarrassed to be seen with the book, unlike you. So I've been very lucky in my cover because I think it appeals to young adults, and so young adults are picking it up. And librarians feel like they can give it to young adults because it doesn't look like it has a heavily romantic element to it. And the Nookie, I mean, the Nookie is in there, but it's not explicit.
Right.
I don't write erotica, so it's not very graphic. And so, yeah, it's sort of been recognized recently as something that does kind of appeal to kids. So I'm really excited about that because I did, before I wrote this book, I did sort of consider myself a young adult author. That was what I wrote before this. So to have younger readers is really exciting to me, although I do have to be very careful about what I tweet as a result.
Yes, darn that online presence.
Yes. I do have a lot of younger readers who had been given the book by their parents, so that's good. It was vetted. And I always do say, if an adult approaches me, I say, you know, the best way for you to know if this is an appropriate book for your child is to read it first yourself.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there it is. But I think my youngest fan is 14. So I wouldn't say it's good for anybody younger than that, and you should probably be a pretty mature 14 to really get it.
I would agree.
Yeah.
I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old daughter, and I think my 16-year-old daughter would enjoy it. I think it's probably a little too risque for my 13-year-old. She just turned 13, and I'm still telling myself she's not really a teenager. So... But I think my 16...
You keep up with that.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be getting a shotgun real soon, I have a feeling. But I think the 16-year-old would enjoy it a lot, and so I've got it out for her. But I'm also trying... I'm hoping my fiancé will read it, because she likes the same genre, but she's busied with other things. She hasn't read anything in a while, so I keep pimping, Solace, look, you should read this. It's nice. I have it here. You should read
it. It's sitting right there. Yes. Look at it. Isn't it? Well, hopefully, I have sold the audio rights, so I'm hoping it'll come out in audio sometime in the next year or two, because I really, like we've discussed, I really enjoy podcasts, and I was raised on audiobooks, and I do tend to write in a style that I think is best read out loud. I often read my own work out loud to make sure I've got everything the way I want it, the way I want it sounding.
Mm-hmm.
So I am hoping that they do actually release it as a book on tape, because I know a lot of people who are more likely to listen to it than they are to read it in this day and age.
And that is me. And that was one of my questions. I embraced podcasting early, as I did, because I enjoyed audiobooks and the idea of being able to get serialized fiction. And I have come to enjoy authors like J. Daniel Sawyer and Chris Lester, who you would never find, at least not right away, without podcasts. And so when I heard, you know, the first chapter of your novel produced as excellently as it was by J. Daniel Sawyer, what hooked me on it. I mean, I had heard about the book before, and I was like, that sounds really good, but I don't have time to pick up a book, blah, 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 when, you know. But as soon as I heard it, I said, I have to read this book. And I will tell you, this is the first book I have read in a very long time, because I am an audiobook person and an ebook person. If I can't take it with me on a device that I have, I don't read it. I don't like carrying a book around with me, because I have to make sure I have it with me. And then where am I going to be? Can I read during my lunch break? Can I read when I get home? Blah, blah, blah. And it's, I don't want to say it's a chore, but I prefer ebooks and audiobooks. And I will say I was so happy to find that you did have an ebook version that Orbit produced.
Yep, Orbit did it. I mean, I think in the modern age you have to. I don't think there's a choice anymore,
right,
really, on ebooks. And they bought electronic rights for me. It was a no contest part of the contract when we were first dealing with it. And I was happy to give them the ebook rights because I was like, absolutely, put it out there. You know, like, I could do it myself, of course, but definitely take it and run with it. And they brought the ebook out. At least they brought the Kindle out right, the Kindle edition out right when the book was being released. And I think the ebook was very soon to follow. And of course, hush, don't tell anybody. You can absolutely get it on BitTorrent and places like that. Although,
yes.
I know. Nobody comes to me, guys. So, you know, I would like to earn out.
Oh, it's an excellent book. Everyone go out there and get this book.
I support audio, absolutely, obviously. I'm totally addicted to podcasts. I think maybe it's a byproduct of living in California, where anything you want to do is going to take you an hour to 2 hours to drive to get there, and nobody thinks twice about getting in their car and driving for a couple of hours. It's just what you do in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to listen to something, especially something as enjoyable as Metamore City or Down from 10, mm-hmm. is like a godsend. And I used to just haunt the libraries for books on tape. That was what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But you can blow through a library collection of things that interest you, especially if you're specifically interested in science fiction and fantasy, as I was, you can get through that pretty darn fast, and suddenly you have nothing to listen to. So podcasting could not have come at a better time for me. I just love it so much. It was actually Dan's idea to do the first chapter. He offered to do it, and I just leapt at the chance and recruited all of my friends to be the voices and stuff, and it was a blast. He did me really proud.
Yes.
I owe him a
good man.
Big favor for that one. Yeah, he's a sweetheart. But it was really good. And then of course, the side effect of that was that I had a lot of people being like, okay, so where's the rest of the podcast?
Right. Yeah.
And I was like, I'm sorry, guys, I sold audio rights. But Orbit Unlucky is really sort of forward-thinking for a publishing house. They're new. They're only a couple years old. I think about five now. They were only 2 years old when they pulled me in. And so they're pretty progressive about, so when Little Author Beast goes bouncing up to them and says, hey, I got this friend. He wants to do a podcast of the first chapter. The Orbit was like, sure, whatever.
Sure,
you know,
yes.
Go to, Little Author, go to, you know. So, which I think a lot of the larger, more established houses wouldn't, you know, we have audio rights, you can't do that,
right,
you know, kind of thing. So I was also lucky in my house that they kind of let me bumble about in my way and go around the internet dropping cookies here and there.
Most excellent. Well, I hope that comes out soon. I will, of course, like I said, I've already pre-ordered the book, and I am going to read it as soon as it gets into my hot little hands. But
yay! But, I hope you like it.
Oh, but I do say if audiobooks, that would be my preferred format, and I hope they do come out, because I wouldn't mind listening to it too, just to get different experience listening
to it. Exactly, and it's such a good experience. I do love listening. I always find I get different things out of a book if I'm listening to it than when I'm reading it. I'm a terrible speed reader, so I do tend to skim.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certainly authors that I cannot read, but I can listen to.
Yeah.
I don't know if you find this, but Isaac Asimov is one of mine. Like, I can happily plonk in his short stories in particular, and I'm delighted to listen to them, but I just could not read him. So I think I discover new and different authors because of audio than I normally would as well. So I'm hoping, and you know, there's a whole kind of cadre of society that you miss out if you don't come out on audio, dyslexics and blind and that kind of thing. So I really am hoping they bought it, so hopefully they'll do it.
Here's hoping. And hopefully they're listening. We want audio. While we're talking about audio and talking about podcasts, what are the genres of podcasts do you listen to? Do you listen to audiobooks? Do you just listen to... I mean, I know you are a fan not only of Mer Lafferty, but of a lot of Quick and Dirty Tips.
Yes.
But what do you listen to?
Oh, my God. There's so many options. What time do we have? I came into rather... prosaically, I'm afraid, I came into podcast because of a panel at, I believe it was the Anaheim Worldcon, and Steve Ely was there, and he was talking about this strange thing called podcasting and Escape Pod, and so the first podcast I ever listened to was Escape Pod, and I thought, this is brilliant, short fiction, science fiction, and it's all in like an hour, and I tend to have, at the time I think I was teaching or something, I know I'm an academic, I'm an archaeologist, so what we end up doing is teaching all too often. So I think I was teaching at a university somewhere, and I probably had about an hour drive, and so look, there they are, little short stories. I can listen to a short story in an hour, it's fantastic. I love short fiction. I'm a really big fan of it because I think it is a really difficult art form as a writer to master. And so well-written short fiction, I really, really respect. I have a hard time with it myself. I will do it, and I enjoy doing it, and like most writers, I kind of got my first publications were all short, but I just got contracted for a short story, and I'm like, I'm really struggling with it because it's been so long since I've written short, and I forgot how hard it is. It's really hard. So that was the first thing that brought me in. So I started out with Escape Pod, but I rapidly migrated into nonfiction. And I don't know why, because I'm not a reader of nonfiction at all, but I really enjoy a lot of the like Quick and Dirty Tips series, and MERS. I love interviews, so I listen to like Dragon Page and Excellent. Slice of Sci-Fi, although sometimes they'll piss me off. yeah, all of those kinds of things. I mean, I could tell you the whole list, but so those are what I do spend a lot of time listening. And I've become, since I'm not commuting as frequently anymore, more and more into really short podcasts. So I like Shortcomings Audio. You know, he's nice, bite-sized. I think that's why I like the Quick and Dirty Tips guys, too, because they're sort of under 10 minutes kind of things. I can listen to them while I'm in the shower or something like that. And then I'm addicted to all the NPR. You know, I was raised as a screaming, bleeding heart liberal, so I listen to
Excellent.
All those guys. Wait, Don't Tell Me, and is always top of my list.
Cool.
And then I'm eclectic, so, I mean, I have a lot of fashion podcasts that I listen to because I'm a little bit of a clothes horse. And DIY stuff like Threadbringer and things like that. What else do I... Yeah, Savage Love. I love Savage Love.
Brilliant.
And Geeks On. I think Geeks On was probably the second podcast that I discovered. So I discovered Escape Pod, and then I discovered Geeks On, and I was like, oh, so podcasts can do interviews and discussion forums. And so then I got into the Galactica Water Cooler people, because I was a big Battlestar Galactica fan. And yeah, it just escalated to, you know, 156 podcasts or however many it is I have on my feed. I mean, recently I dropped my Nano in the bathtub. It was a crisis of epic proportions.
Oh, no.
And there was no Apple store within, like, 20 miles of where I'm living. And I was, so I had to drive the whole hour without an iPod in order to get a new iPod.
Tragic.
I know. I was like, wait, I was shaking. What did I do before? How do I drive without a podcast in my ear?
Oh, I know. I don't even listen to terrestrial radio anymore. If I can't listen to a podcast because of something I hasn't downloaded recently, I'll just play music. But I don't even listen to the radio anymore. My phone gives me GPS, so I know where the traffic is. I have news. I mean, who needs old media, right? So
yeah, that's pretty much it.
Except for
like,
print.
Oh.
Except for print. We love Orbit. Orbit is good.
Yes, of course. I have a relatively new car, and I was like, oh, do I have a radio on this car?
Didn't even know.
I don't know. Wait, how do I work this dial thing? Oh.
I can't fast forward. I can't rewind. What's with this?
And then, you know, again, it's California. I'm driving 90-odd miles, and there's 8 different radios. And so every 20 minutes, I have to change the station because whatever station I was listening to is no longer there. I've gone over a hill.
Wow.
So, it's very frustrating, this radio thing. So thank God I have my new little iPod.
Yeah.
And and I'm back to sanity. But it was a very long day that day without my iPod.
I feel your pain. Podcasting Anonymous.
Yes, I know they should have a program. I also listened to, not to continue on the podcasting thing, but I listened to T's Adventures. No, that's Sean. I listened to Sean Farrell's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing and T's Survivor Guide and Myr. So I've listened to all three of those.
Good.
And unfortunately for me, I started listening to them sort of right after I'd sold the book and got the contract. But just for if any of your listeners out there are kind of wannabe writers, I can't recommend those guys highly enough.
Absolutely. Like, I listened to them as well.
Unbelievably helpful. Even after I'd sold, I'd used T's sort of tips on how to get together a press kit for setting up the press kit part of my web page and stuff. I mean, just like invaluable.
What's your favorite genre to read?
I have settled pretty firmly over the years into what I would call soft fantasy. And I'm not ashamed to admit it, but like sort of Mercedes Lackey, kind of that kind of fantasy.
Okay.
Not necessarily talking horses, but kind of gentler fantasies. I'm not a doorstopper reader, so I don't pick up Robert Jordan.
Okay.
It's just honestly, I can't afford the time. I'm a fast reader, so I can read a Mercedes Lackey book, even a relatively big one, in 3 hours, but Robert Jordan, anything that's over 4 or 5 hour time commitment, and I'm unwilling these days to give it the time. So that's one. And then I also really like kind of military sci-fi, but that has political and characterization twists to it. So I'm thinking kind of Tonya Hoff Fowler series and Deborah Doyle and James D. McDonald's Star Pilot series. I thought that was wonderful. So I'll do those. And I read a lot of YA.
Mm-hmm.
One of my other hats is I'm actually a paid professional reviewer of young adult. So I have from 6 to 12 YA books that I usually have to read a month.
Wow.
So I read a lot of YA. Luckily, it's pretty fast to read.
Mm-hmm.
But I read a lot of crap YA. So I have to read it to review it. But I do find some gems in amongst them. So I enjoy doing it because you never know what's going to cross the desk. But I usually do historical fantasy or myth-based or sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on the list for those specific ones as being the things I'm willing to read, so I read those. And then I usually have some sort of stack of nonfiction stuff that I'm reading for various research purposes, so that's there as well. And I have your standard stack of things that I'm supposed to be reading on my list. Like, I have Ken Scholes' Lamentation to read, and like Charlton's new book, Spellwright. I want to read that one. So I kind of have a little pile of things that I'm trying to get through also.
What do you think of all of these new Jane Austen undead mashup type novels that are out there?
I can't really express an opinion because I actually haven't read any.
Okay.
And I did ask some of my friends and, you know, whose opinions I respect, and they reported in that, you know, some of them kind of liked some of the ideas. But, I mean, it seems like a lot of work to kind of, not to put too fine a point on it, but to steal someone else's story.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like you might as well. I mean, I certainly owe a lot to Austen, or in my case, kind of more kind of P.G. Woodhouse and Elizabeth Gaskell, but given the time period setting. But I certainly have that aesthetic.
Right. And, but that's a setting for you. That's not, you know, Mr. Darcy and, you know.
Right. It's kind of one thing to pay homage and, you know, and it's another thing to be derivative, and it's another thing to rewrite someone else's book,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, yeah, she's been dead a long time, but that's what you're doing. So, I can kind of get the craze, but I'm not sold on it. I think you should just write your own thing that has, you know, similar setting. And you know, I love I think it's a great idea. I think the idea of taking zombies and sticking them into Regency England is a pretty cool idea.
Right.
But I don't see that you have to take beloved characters in order to do it. So that's kind of where I stand on it. But like I said, I haven't read it, so I may be made to eat my words if it was done brilliantly.
Well, I haven't read it either, but I do have to admit I am looking forward to the Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter one, because you can't get a wilder mashup than that. So I'm actually interested in that.
You're really good.
So, and that's by the same author as Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies. So I'm looking forward to that. But
and it is, I mean, there's a great kind of steampunk shot somewhere out there on the internet of Abraham Lincoln with sort of a steampunk blunderbuss kind of weapon, which is a pretty cool picture. So I can see the appeal. It's pretty, and I do know that the guy who wrote those two, I can't remember his name, I'm sorry.
Seth Graham-Smith or something.
Yeah, he really researches his stuff.
Sure.
I mean, he's not a slacker. He really goes in and takes a look at it. So, but I like to play too much. I mean, I'm going to alienate a lot of people here, but I've always felt this a little bit about gaming, and by all means, go to if that's your thing, but I've always been like, why am I want to play in somebody else's world? I want to write my own world. I want to build my own world, darn it.
Absolutely.
So that's kind of a little bit how I feel about the Pride and Prejudice and Zombies craze. Is I'm like, well, you know, it's all fun to play with someone else's characters, but really, Jane Austen doesn't have a Lord Akeldama. So,
exactly.
You know, and I want Lord Akeldamas in my world.
Yay.
So yeah, that's kind of where I went with it.
Excellent. And you know, I've also got to mention that I love your novel because of the sense of humor in the novel. It's very Douglas Adams, I would say, is the influence that I definitely saw in it. In fact, I think in chapter two alone, I saw like three little nods to Douglas Adams, which were brilliant. So either my bias picked them out, or you're a huge fan and you shoved them in there. Again, you
may be so much a part of my psyche that I've done that. I couldn't point them out, but you're probably right.
There's a reference to Thursdays in there, and then there was a reference to Lord Macon's specialty was doing lots of impossible things before dawn, things like that.
Right. So I forgot about that. Yeah, I'm totally still addicted to the first of the Hitchhiker books. Like I can probably recite whole chapters by heart. I just love, and I listened to them. Mm-hmm. It was an audio thing for me. I got into him from audio, and so definitely Terry Pratchett as well. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge fan of both of those, but more than that, it was another thing that I kind of noticed seemed to me to be missing in the urban fantasy genre in particular, and in steampunk also. Steampunk tends to be very cerebral and literary, and I'm not dissing it, but it takes itself very seriously. There's a lot of dystopian elements.
Right.
And urban fantasy tends to be, even if you're Jim Butcher and you do put a lot of humor into it, it does tend to be dark. You know, urban fantasy writers tend to rape their main characters and put them just through hell and back.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, that's okay to read, and I enjoy it, and it's nice to have a good weep now and again when you're reading a good book. But I love the fun books. The books that I keep and the books I go back to are Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett and Jasper Fure and all these comedy writers, and they tend to be men, and they tend to be fantasy or sci-fi. And I was like, well, it's time urban fantasy got a little fun.
Excellent.
And so that was entirely intentional. The other side of that was that anytime I sold a short story, it was always a comedy piece. And I was like, okay, so editors like me to write comedy. That's what they're buying from me. So let's see if I can do a whole book with it. It's hard. Writing comedy is so difficult. But I can get away with things as a comedy writer that I think epic fantasy in particular or hardcore sci-fi really can't get away with. Like, for example, I don't have to kill my darlings.
Right.
You know, like they can keep surviving absurd situations because it's comedy, and I can just get away with that.
Right.
And I can always break, not necessarily break the fourth wall, but I can certainly break character, and I can break trope, and I can muck around with the story in the interest of amusing my audience, which gives you a little bit of freedom in a certain arena. I'm pleased to be writing comedy, and I do keep doing that. I mean, I will add a couple of serious elements in there, but I love making people laugh, and I want to leave people smiling, I think. And I don't want to be taken seriously. So I think if you put down the book and you're grinning, then that's it. I've done my job.
You have done your job. It was an excellent joy to read the book. And I don't want to take up any more of your time because I've had you on the phone for like an hour now. So before I let you go, though, where can people find out more about you and your books?
Well, you can find me at GailCarriger.com. That's www.GailCarriger.com. And there's pretty much a link to everything there, but if I'm under Gail Carriger everywhere. You can find me under Gail Carriger on Facebook and Twitter, and I have a blog on LiveJournal that's also shadowed on Blogspot, so I'm pretty much all over the internet.
And your blog is an absolute hoot to read as well.
Oh, thank you. I try to keep it entertaining.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, it's full of, like, if you can kind of tell what part of the writing process I'm in, because sometimes it's full of the weird Victorian thing that I discovered today while I was doing research.
Right.
And sometimes it's full of, like, this is what it's like with a copy edit. You know, I'm getting mocked openly by my copy editor, that kind of a thing. So you can always tell where I am in the writing process. But it's fun to be out there, I think, on the internet as a writer. It's one of the advantages we have in this particular day and age, because it used to be such an isolating profession, and now everybody can get a hold of you, and it's great. You feel like you're actually putting something out there that's being read. It's not going out into the void anymore.
Right.
The void is full of voices.
And they keep talking to you.
And they keep talking to me. The voices in my head, they're twittering.
So, one last question. What's next for Alexia and the gang after these three books? You kind of hinted that there might be more.
I did. All I can say is that I have the three books under contract, and I've turned in all three of them. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, I've turned in Solus. And I can imagine more books in the series.
Excellent.
But probably not any more than five. I don't want to turn into a Laurel K. Hamilton, so I'm happy to kind of have an arc and finish with my characters. And I would certainly be happy to sort of explore the world more mm-hmm. after that, but probably not with Alexia as a main character anymore. So that's what we'll leave it at that. And I have other projects. I just finished a short piece for Anne and Jeff Vandermeer's steampunk anthology that's coming out soon. It's not a fiction piece, it's a nonfiction piece,
oh,
but I had a lot of fun
excellent.
Writing that one, all about dressing steampunk, which I tend to do. And I also am doing a short piece for the Mammoth Book of Paranormal Romance 2, which is a British publication, and I'm writing a fiction piece for that, but it's contemporary.
Oh.
And I'm really enjoying writing it because I forgot how easy it is to write contemporary. I don't have to look anything up.
Right.
Like, I don't have to write something and then be like, oh, did they have Lunchable spoons in the Victorian era? And have to go run off and see if they did. So those two are coming up. And yeah, those are the things I can talk about. There's other secret other projects, but I know a lot to talk about.
Okay, shh. I won't ask them. Well, on that note, thank you very much, Gail, for joining me. And I wish you all the best. And I'm looking forward to Blameless and Changeless coming soon.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for having me. And it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up another episode of the Out of the Coffin podcast. Thanks for listening. This blog and podcast are copyright by Dan Charette and are released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. Some rights reserved. If you have any comments about this podcast, feel free to drop a note at outofthecoffin.com/contact. Or, if you'd rather leave some voicemail, you can call us at 206-350-7638.